Hi, everybody. I'm Raj Mago. Some of you I met earlier today on the other stage, and hopefully you remember me. This lighting pisses me off. This lighting makes me look a little different from my photo. I'm glad I put my photo there because you probably like see me a little bit different on the Zoom. Anyway, I'm editor-in-chief of a website, simpleandpractical.com. Hopefully many of you have checked it out. Some of you are subscribers. If you have not, please do take a look at the reviews on the website, Simple and Practical. I hope you like the name. I'm also affiliated with two different universities where I teach about psychopharmacology, and I'm trying to make a sensible, practical curriculum about how to teach psychopharmacology over several years of training for psychiatry residents. Here are my disclosures. Before we start, I want to remind you, please answer the pretest questions. They will be on your right. I think you're probably already seeing them. Please do answer those because we'll go back to them at the end. So our objectives are very simple. You know, we want to learn about strategies that will help us to reduce the risk of side effects when possible, and when not possible, then the strategies for treating those side effects of the various common side effects. So when we say common side effects, you know, what kind of things are we talking about? Just simple things like nausea, dry mouth, excessive sweating, tremors, akathisia, sexual dysfunction, weight gain, and tardive dyskinesia. So somewhat arbitrarily chose those side effects that I see on a daily basis in my patients. So what sucks about this issue of side effects, and why I'm on a mission to kind of educate people about taking side effects very seriously, is that the majority of these side effects because of which the people stop taking their medicines are not like things that are going to harm, you know, your thyroid or your kidney or your heart. That's not why people stop. People stop because of simple things like nausea, or their hands are shaking, or they have diarrhea or something like that. Right? Am I right? Many years ago, I talked about this distinction between nuisance side effects and medically serious side effects. And I like to say that to patients also. Hey, listen, this is a nuisance side effect. So by nuisance side effects, I mean, not that we are not going to take it seriously, not that it's not bothersome, but at least it's not harming any organ of your body, you know? But yet people stop taking their medication because of these kind of side effects. And then the other thing is that many of these, not all, but many of these things would have subsided if the patient had stayed on the medication for a few weeks, right? So that is even more frustrating, because if we can somehow, this is the thing, if we can somehow get the person to stay on the medication for 30 days, then the chances are that they are going to be fine and they will be able to take the medication for like 1 year or 5 years or whatever long period of time. So that's why these things that we are going to talk about today are so important, because, you know, we have to get them off to a good start. So really, this is not even a talk. It's a call to action. It's a call to action. Let us, as a field, develop for each side effect. We should have a menu of options. It's not mathematical. It's not like, oh, if they have nausea, I give them this. If they have sweating, I give them this. You have to have a menu of options, because they have to be at, you know, non-pharmacological strategies and pharmacological. I don't mean to say that anybody who has a side effect, we have to give them another medication to treat the side effect, right? And then that has its own side effects. So that's not what we are saying. We're saying we have to have a range of options, simple things, more complicated things. I came up with, you know, I just call them, there's no such thing, but I just call them level one, level two, and level three. What I mean is they're simpler things, that there's no harm doing these, and then maybe a little bit more active. And then level three would be things that you just save them only if this medicine is absolutely essential. You know, sometimes we have a medication that's working great for this patient and nothing else seemed to work. I really, really don't want to stop this medication that's working for the patient. So I might be willing to do a lot to keep the person on this medication. You know, for example, clozapine. is an example, but you're not, it's not so easy to say, oh, let's just switch the medication, right? But it also happens with antidepressants and antipsychotics and so on. Okay, so let's talk about some examples just to give you an idea. What do I mean by level one, level two, level three? What would be examples of that? So we start with nausea. Now, nausea is amazingly common. If you look it up in the physician's desk reference, and we consider anything that occurs twice as often as placebo, we consider that to be associated with the medication. Some of the medicines, like 20-30% of patients will spontaneously report that they had nausea. If you ask them, have you had any problems with the medicine? They say, oh, it's making me nauseous, right? So very high percentages. So it's very common. And then the other thing is, it's very uncomfortable. Like if I have a headache, maybe I can bear it. I can easily take Tylenol or something. But when you have nausea, it's a horrible feeling. Those of you, everybody has had nausea at some times, you remember this. Did you know that when you do look at antidepressant clinical trials, the most common cause of stopping the antidepressant early on was nausea? Always. Look up any antidepressant study, you'll find nausea right up there. So an example of a level one simple thing that we can do is we should always titrate the antidepressant up over 1 week or so, right? There's an actual study that showed if you start duloxetine at 60 milligram versus you give it for 30 milligram for 1 week and then go up to 60 milligram, the rates of nausea go down by half. 50% decrease You see, it went from 33% to 16%. So we should do this all the time. What I do is I tell people, you know, if I prescribe escitalopram 10 milligram, I say take half a pill for the first, you know, 6 days or 8 days, even number of days, because it's half pill. And then you go up. We should be always doing this and ignoring what the FDA recommended starting dose is. Really simple. Another very simple thing is that if we can somehow, you know, here's the most of the side effects, not all, but most of the side effects are related to the peak levels. So the person takes the medicine and it's absorbed, the blood levels rise and then fall down. The peak level is important. And so if we can reduce the peak level of medicine, a lot of side effects, their incidence goes down. So what do we mean? How can we do that? If a sustained release preparation is available, the sustained release should be preferred. If the sustained release is not available, which is true for many medicines, then we can split the dose and give it with separate meals, even if it's not really needed. Even if it's a long-acting medicine or its effect is long-acting, we don't need to split the dose. So for example, there's a study that showed atomoxetine. Atomoxetine is notorious for causing nausea. It's very irritating to the stomach. If you give it once a day, or you give it twice a day, right? The incidence of nausea goes down by half. Half, just like that. How easy can it get? Cannot get easier than this. So I always prescribe, when I prescribe atomoxetine, I usually say 25 milligram, you know, take 25 milligram with one meal and then go to 25 milligram twice daily. So I'm kind of combining the idea of titrating up as well as splitting it. After the first 30 days, whatever dose they are on, I'll just give it as a single dose. But for the first 30 days, I titrate up and I split the dose. Massive, massive improvement in the tolerability of the medication. Very easy. Now, one more thing that you can do if this is, you know, not sufficient, patients calling back and reporting nausea, is to give ginger root. Ginger root. This is not an old wives' tale, okay? They're actual randomized controlled studies. The references are on the slide. They've used it in cancer chemotherapy induced nausea. They've used it in pregnancy, hyperemesis gravidarum. And it comes in only one strength, 550 milligram. And the person can take either one or two at a time and up to three times a day. Should not exceed that dose under any circumstances. Now, what if these things are not enough? Like the person is, you know, having persistent nausea. I've had people like that where they can't tolerate the medication. Then you can go to a higher level. You can use ondansetron. Brand name Zofran. We all know about ondansetron. It's a powerful anti-nausea medication used in patients who are getting cancer chemotherapy. But now it's become dirt cheap. We used to not be able to give it. Now it's very cheap. For like a month supply, it's like $10 or something. So what I do is I recommend the orally disintegrating tablet, because when the person is having nausea, it's convenient to not even have to drink water with it. And it comes in a 4 milligram pill, and you can use either one or two pills every 6 hours if as needed. Works really well. Ondansetron works by blocking serotonin 3 receptors. All the setrons, ondansetron, granisetron, and so on, what they do is they block serotonin 3 receptors. So what psychiatric medication blocks serotonin 3 receptors very powerfully is mirtazapine. When there are others also, but mirtazapine blocks serotonin 3 receptors. And so mirtazapine has also been used in cancer patients and so on as an anti-nausea medication. You have to use a full dose though, you know, like a 15 milligram. It's not a super low dose. You would have to use about 15 milligram, which would be a starting dose to treat the nausea. Okay, so that gives you an idea that, you know, there are a few different things that one could do for nausea. Let's talk about dry mouth. So why is dry mouth important? Like, why are we even taking time to talk about it? Is because it's very common with our medications, and it causes dental caries. Many of my patients have had to have thousands of dollars of dental work because they were not told by the treating doctor that their dry mouth is going to make them susceptible to having caries. They didn't think the dry mouth was that bothersome. The patient doesn't think it's an extremely serious thing. We have to convince them. In this case, we are the ones who have to convince them, hey, listen, this is serious stuff. We have to do something to treat it, because otherwise you're going to get cavities. So what kind of things can we do? We want to do two things. One is we want to kill the bacteria to prevent cavities. And the other is we want to give them symptom relief by lubricating the mouth in some way. So to kill the bacteria, we recommend xylitol containing products. It could be a xylitol chewing gum. It could be a xylitol lozenge. There are xylitol spray, all kinds of things. The bacteria, they eat xylitol, you know, which is like it's a natural sugar, but it kills them. So in the dental literature, they are randomized controlled trials of xylitol containing products. Chewing gum is good because it mechanically also cleans the teeth. So xylitol containing chewing gum is my top choice. And one detail is that it has to be used 4 times a day, at least 4 times a day before it's separated from placebo. So it's, but a very simple thing. When you go to the grocery store or to the pharmacy where they sell the toothpaste, please look, you'll see a huge range of different brands of xylitol containing products. You can recommend any of them. And then the other thing is to moisturize the mouth in some way. So for example, Biotene is a range of products, comes as a gel, as a rinse, as a chewing gum, as a toothpaste, doesn't matter. So here you see images of the gel, which the person takes a small amount on the finger maybe and put it on the tongue, move it around like that. And the other thing, the bottle that you see on your screen is the oral rinse or the mouthwash. So that can be used twice daily, especially good for the night. Now, what if these simple things are not enough? Then we want to use a medication that can stimulate saliva production. So what medicine can we use to stimulate saliva production? Example of that is pilocarpine. Pilocarpine is a cholinergic medicine, stimulates the salivary glands to secrete saliva. The problem is that pilocarpine, and people will tell you this, people will say, take it orally, prescribe pilocarpine. That's not a great idea because it's going to cause increased secretions everywhere, right? So I don't recommend doing it orally. So what we would prefer is if there was something that we could just use it pilocarpine locally, like just in the mouth for the dry mouth. But unfortunately, not available in that. So what I do is I write for pilocarpine eye drops. Okay, they're available for $4 in paying cash. So pilocarpine eye drops, sorry, going back, should not click. Pilocarpine eye drops. It comes as here I've shown 2%, but I would recommend, you can use the 4% it comes in 1, 2, and 4, so 4%. And in a spoonful of water, like half a spoon of water, literally, the person can like put one or two drops of the pilocarpine and just swish it around the mouth. And very important that they must spit it out afterwards, because if they drink that saliva, then you know, it's like taking pilocarpine orally. It defeats the purpose, right? So this is a neat trick and can give relief for a few hours if a person is like going to a social engagement. They have to maybe do a talk. Like if I'm doing a talk on Zoom, maybe I could use pilocarpine right before that, so I'm not doing this, right? Okay. Next is antidepressant-induced excessive sweating. Many years ago, I started calling it ADs, and it's because it has a long name. So ADs. So the thing with ADs is that it is incredibly common. If you look it up in the physician's desk reference, like I'm not making this stuff up. You can look it up that people, when asked, hey, do you have any problems with the antidepressant? They spontaneously, they're not asking them, hey, do you have excessive sweating? They're just saying, do you have any problem? And they say, yeah, I've been sweating a lot. 22% with bupropion. That's, bupropion has more. People just assume that if you have a problem with the SSRI, you should change to bupropion. That's a generally what people will say. But that's not always true. Sometimes that's true. But in the case of sweating, you're like, you know, out of the frying pan into the fire. So bupropion, remember, has the highest incidence of excessive sweating. SNRIs are second, and then SSRIs as well. So question is what to do, you know, can we wait and see? Maybe it will subside on its own. Maybe we could try dose reduction. See, two things I will not say in this entire talk are, one is change the medication, and second is reduce the dose. Of course, if the dose, you don't need a high dose or whatever dose the person is on, you should reduce the dose. I mean, that should be obvious. But I'm assuming that you're not giving them this dose for no reason. You probably tried the lower dose and it didn't work enough, and that's why you went to the higher dose, right? So it's easy to say dose reduction, but not so easy to do. Agree? And of course, if you could try changing the antidepressant, maybe this antidepressant is not essential. Again, this whole talk is based on the idea that we think this medicine is really good for this patient, or the person has just started this medicine and we think that if the person can stay on the medication, then it may be good for the person. So what can we do to reverse this? My treatment of choice, this is the one I want you to remember, which is glycopyrrolate. Glycopyrrolate is an anticholinergic. And do not please recommend things like, you know, benztropine or Cogentin, because they cross the blood-brain barrier and they cause cognitive impairment. So glycopyrrolate is the preferred, not benztropine. Benztropine, of course, will work also, but it will have a lot more problems of its own. So use glycopyrrolate, it works beautifully. I mean, it's pretty much 100% that it's going to cut down the excessive sweating. The dose is either to give 1 milligram or 2 milligram, and you have to give it 3 times a day because it doesn't last. But what I have over the years, as I start kept using, I published the first case ever published of the use of glycopyrrolate for excessive sweating or ADs. And one of the things I soon realized is, hey, wait a minute. You don't have to take this every day. You can just take it when you need it. So if you are at home and you're in air conditioning, you're not exerting yourself, you're not having the excessive sweating, you don't have to take it. But let's say you have to go outdoors and it's like 90 degrees, or you have to like move stuff in the house or something, then you can take the glycopyrrolate. So that is actually a really particularly cool feature of glycopyrrolate, the fact that you can take it as needed. This is the one you should remember, not the next one. As a backup, the other medication is terazosin. I did a study on terazosin, but I'm not recommending it as the, in 99% of the cases, this is not what you should do. This was actually the first study ever done in the world, ever since antidepressants were invented, on the treatment of antidepressant-induced sweating. The reason I don't recommend it as the first line is because it can cause orthostatic hypotension. It worked really well in my study. Almost every patient had significant improvement. In many of them, it was beautiful. Like they literally, they were, had no more excessive sweating. They were down to normal sweating only. But it needs titration. You know, you have to give 1 milligram per week and then go to 2 milligram per week and so on. In the study, we went only up to 6 milligram per week. Other you know, medications that block the alpha receptors, they also would work, like prazosin, clonidine, and so on. Terazosin was felt to be like a clean drug, doesn't go into the brain that much. So you have two options. Again, you know, going back to the idea that you should have a menu of options. If one thing doesn't work, you go to the next one. All right, so the next one is tremors. So question is, why would tremors be such a big deal? Did you know that for mood stabilizers, one of the top reasons, like why do people stop taking their mood stabilizer? They know they have bipolar disorder and they have had many episodes. They know it's going to really F up their life. Why do they stop taking the medication? One of the reasons, big reasons, is tremors. And the reason tremors are bothersome is that they are socially embarrassing. So when you're in a situation where you're holding a cup or something and the person, they see your hand is shaking, people notice it, right? Of course, now with COVID, we are not going to any parties, but you get the idea. So that's why it's important. It's a leading cause of discontinuation because of that. Also, it's very, very common. A lot of our medicines cause tremors. I mean, literally any of our medicines can cause tremor. Any of our medicines can cause dry mouth. With some medications, the incidence is really high. One tip I have is that if you're going to do something, and we'll talk about what we can do, if there's something you're going to do to treat the tremor, it would be good, right? If we could monitor the progress, like we could do something and then see if the treatment really worked. So one of the things, one tip is to monitor it, to know whether the tremor is better, you can have the person draw a spiral. Draw a spiral, keeping the lines really close to each other and neatly. And what happens is the tremor becomes very apparent. Now you keep this, then do whatever it is that you're gonna do to treat the tremor. And then after a month or whatever, have them do the same thing. Now when you put the two sheets of paper together, you're like, whoa. Here it was, the hand was really shaking, like, you know, the line was very shaky. A person had maybe difficulty even keeping them, the lines steady. And now here it's much more clear cut. Hopefully, at least we hope that the treatment will work. So this is a cool thing to do. Hey, Paige, you know one thing? I'm in private practice. So one of the things I learned is like how to engage the patient, how to keep the patient involved. Patients love this kind of stuff. If all we do is, you know, hey, take this medicine, see you next time, then everybody does that. But patients like when the clinician does these extra things, and patients would like to see, you know, like if they see that and they can see for themselves, like, wow, what a difference it's made. Okay, so what do we do to treat the tremors? One is reduce caffeine. Caffeine increases tremors of all kinds because it alters the sympathetic tone to the periphery. And so when we reduce caffeine, in general, tremors tend to decrease. But with lithium, we have to be cautious. Why do we have to be cautious if we are reducing caffeine? Isn't that a good thing? Think about it for a second. If you're reducing caffeine, what's that going to do to lithium? The answer is that caffeine is a diuretic. So you've got to pee more. And so the lithium levels are kept on the lower side by if your person is using caffeine. But if a person was drinking 10 cups of coffee per day, which I see all the time, is not rare, and then they cut down to zero or only to one or two, the lithium levels will rise. And there was a paper published many years ago, which had a title. It had a good, interesting title. Drinking less, but shaking more. Drinking less, but shaking more. That's what happens with caffeine. the person is drinking less caffeine, but the shaking, instead of getting better, actually got worse. So if there is a dramatic decrease in the caffeine intake, if they're going down a lot, then please recheck the lithium level or even consider reducing the lithium level a little bit to compensate for the diuresis. So small point, but can make a big difference in some patients. The other is use sustained release preparations. That I said is a general principle. If you use sustained release preparations, you're gonna have less side effects because of the peak level issue that we talked about. And the person who has tremors, whatever medicine they are taking, move it to bedtime. Even if it's an antidepressant, try to move it to bedtime so that the peak will be during the sleep. Now, antipsychotic induced tremor, we all know that the standard treatment is to give an anticholinergic like benztropine, right? Cogentin, benztropine, and you can give 1 milligram twice daily or, go up to 6 milligram. One thing about benztropine that I see people making this mistake is they give it at bedtime. When the person has Parkinsonian, the shaking and stiffness and all, it goes away during sleep. So there's no point giving benztropine at bedtime, right? All the time I see this, the patient will be taking one in a pill in the morning and one at bedtime. No, you should tell them to take it during the day, during waking hours. So maybe, morning, afternoon, and then around 6 o'clock or something like that. Anyway, so this we know, everybody knows anticholinergics, but the one thing that people don't use is amantadine. Amantadine is another treatment for antipsychotic-induced tremor. And for lithium-induced tremor, we use beta blockers. That also people know. But one detail is that beta blockers, some of them enter the brain and some of them don't enter the brain. The ones that don't enter the brain, atenolol is my drug of choice, actually. Metoprolol at high doses will enter the brain, but at lower doses will not. When you're trying to treat peripheral tremors, the beta blockade is occurring peripherally. It's not beta, the beta receptors are not in the brain, in the basal ganglia. In the case of benztropine, you need a centrally acting because the effect is occurring at the level of the basal ganglia. So by not using a centrally acting beta blocker, we can reduce central side effects like nightmares and so on. Okay, the next thing we're going to talk about is akathisia. Horrible, horrible side effect, right? The restlessness, can't sit still. So we all know that some of our medications have a high incidence of akathisia, right? Compared to others. With brexpiprazole, there is a claim that it has less akathisia, but keep in mind that brexpiprazole in its studies was very slowly titrated up, while aripiprazole was not. So it's not like really a fair comparison. In terms of aripiprazole. One of the things, I learned by having made this mistake, I was involved in a lot of the original research that led to the use of aripiprazole for major depressive disorder. And we were forced to increase the dose. We had to go from 5 to 10 to 15 and to 20 rapidly. Now I've learned my lesson, and I think all of you have also, right? Don't we all now give aripiprazole 2 milligram or 2.5? What I do usually is, instead, I use the 5 milligram pill. I tell them it's not scored. It's not scored, but doesn't matter. You can break it. It's a long acting medicine. So it doesn't have to be exactly half. It'll even out if you have a big piece one day and a smaller piece the next day. So start with 2.5. Wait, it's long acting. So you shouldn't increase the dose very rapidly unless it's an emergency, depending on the situation. But in an outpatient with major depressive disorder, I try to have them take 2.5 for at least 6 days. Then if there's no problem, go up and so on. So what should we use to treat akathisia? The most important thing is to identify. I want to make a plug for this, that many times the patient has akathisia and we don't realize it. We don't realize it because we think that it might be that the person is anxious, maybe they are restless, maybe even they have ADHD, and they have insomnia. While really, it's an inner restlessness, which is a side effect. So any of us can miss this side effect, and so we really need to be on the alert. Now, to reduce akathisia, like I said, the most important single thing to do is to titrate the medication up. Another thing is to check the serum ferritin. As you probably know, the serum ferritin is the best single test for total body iron stores. And having low iron stores is known to be a risk factor for restless leg syndrome and probably also for akathisia. So we should check it just to make. Have you not noticed that the same person is prone to have akathisia? Like they'll have akathisia with one medicine and then they'll have akathisia with another medicine. So it's obviously something that makes them prone. And one of the things could be that they have low serum ferritin. Why not check? Now, akathisia, like other side effects, tends to be dose dependent. If anybody asks you for any side effect, does it depend on the dose? You should always say yes, because there are very few side effects for which are not dose dependent. Those are a small number. Almost all side effects are dose dependent. So of course you can reduce the dose if that's clinically possible. And again, if you started the person on aripiprazole and they had horrible akathisia, maybe early on, maybe it might be a good idea to switch in this case, because it's like a losing battle. But let's assume that the person is doing well on this medicine. They have akathisia. You don't want to, for whatever reason, we're going to assume that in this particular patient, you don't want to change the medication. Then what should you do? Please don't give them anticholinergics. Now, some of you are thinking like, of course I would not do that. But many people are prescribing anticholinergics for akathisia. And you need to stop doing that. People refer to akathisia as extrapyramidal sin. It's part of an extrapyramidal symptoms or extrapyramidal side effects. And that's why we think that because we give anticholinergics for Parkinsonism, drug-induced Parkinsonism, that we can give anticholinergics for akathisia also. That is not true. The mechanism is different. So the drug of choice, which you probably know, has always been said to be propranolol. Now here you can't use a atenolol because you want the drug to cross the blood-brain barrier. 20 milligrams, you have to start on a low dose because of the risk of bradycardia. It's a pain in the behind, you know. 20 milligram twice daily, then go to 40 milligram twice daily and maybe later change to a long-acting. But even though technically like that is supposed to be the drug of choice, in reality, it's not so convenient to prescribe it. And so, one thing is like to give immediate relief. Because can you imagine like if you had this thing where you couldn't sit still and like all day long, you know, and even when you're trying to fall asleep, you were restless. You know, if that ever happens to me, I'm like, shoot me up with benzo or whatever, like just until you do something about it. You caused this problem. So now I want you to clean it up. So clonazepam, I give the patient relief by giving them clonazepam. And I recommend, I don't know if you've heard of this, but mirtazapine treats akathisia because akathisia is believed to be caused by the serotonin 2A receptors. Anything that blocks serotonin 2A receptors helps to treat akathisia. But it's very important that you don't use more than 15 milligrams. So 15 milligram and don't go up above that. Also, it'll help with sleep, right? Like if the person has akathisia, but at least thankfully they can sleep at night. So this is another great thing to have in your armamentarium. You know, this is part of that menu idea that you have many different options and you use them as appropriate for that particular patient. Let's talk about sexual dysfunction. Huge problem, which, you know, we wish we had better solutions for the problem of medication-induced sexual dysfunction. If the person says, what are my chances of getting sexual dysfunction? You know, the answer is about 25%. If you look at people, because sexual dysfunction could be due to many reasons. It's hard to know that it's just due to this medicine. When they've done large study looking at people who were taking only one antidepressant, they were not elderly, you know, they didn't have other medical illnesses, etc., it's 25%. That's a lot of people. Considering that, you know, more than 10% of the population is taking an antidepressant, 25% of that is a lot of people who have antidepressant-induced sexual dysfunction. Now, is it more in men or in women? I'll give you a second to think of the answer. Is antidepressant-induced sexual dysfunction more in men or more in women? The answer is that it's the same. It's the same. When looked at, when it has been systematically studied, it was the same in men and in women. In fact, it may be more severe in women. Now, the reason we think that it's more in men is because men complain more about the sexual dysfunction. And, you know, I like to say that my wife says that men complain more about everything. So that's not enough of a reason. The practical implication of talking about this is that women may not tell you that they have the sexual dysfunction. So we have to be more, in women, we have to be more proactive in specifically asking about how their sexuality is, you know. Now, what should we do about antidepressant-induced sexual dysfunction? Maybe we can wait and watch. Maybe we can reduce the dose. Maybe we can use drug holidays, switch, or add an antidote. Like this is our supposed menu, and I'm going to comment on these points. So for wait and watch, you know, it's not a great idea at all. I used to always tell patients, hey, just stay on the medication. I think the sexual dysfunction will get better. No, it won't. It won't. Most probably it won't. Only a very few people have, even after a long period of waiting, many, many, many months, can have a full improvement. 90% of people will not have a full improvement in the sexual dysfunction. So I know many of you like to watch, but it's not a good idea in this case to wait and watch with this kind of sexuality. So if the person has mild sexual dysfunction, it's an orgasmic problem, it's less than 4 to 6 months, you know, like early on, I don't mean that you jump in and do something about it, but you could, you know, stay with it if it's early on. Now, next thing we can do is drug holidays. So drug holidays doesn't mean like, going to Colorado. Some people think, you know, go to Colorado, it's a drug holiday. No, but when I say drug holiday, what I mean is that the person misses the medication. You tell the person to not take the medication for either 1 or 2 days, typically 2 days in a week. And it does work for in a significant proportion of people. So like, Not of course, if the antidepressant is long acting, well, then that's not going to work, right? But for the shorter acting medications, a certain person, like for whom like having sex like once a week is enough, if for certain people of a certain age and whatever, it is an option. It's an option. I'm not saying this is the best and the only option, but I'm saying this is one more option in your menu. Now, the other thing you can do is, of course, is to switch to another antidepressant. Because we don't have great treatments for antidepressant-induced sexual dysfunction, if it is an option, of course, you would like to switch. So bupropion, mirtazapine, transdermal selegiline, moclobemide. Moclobemide is an antidepressant that's available in Canada, but it can be easily imported. It can be easily ordered online. And it's not more effective than others, but it is a much better tolerated antidepressant than many of the antidepressants that we have here. So it's an option in terms of side effects. I like moclobemide. Now, if you did a survey of mental health clinicians throughout the country and asked them, what do you do when a person has SSRI-induced sexual dysfunction? The most common answer you will get is that I would add bupropion. I was taught this when I was a resident way back, and I've heard this everywhere. There have been actual studies that have shown that this is what people say, you know, surveys have been done, but ain't true. I'm here to tell you, it's a myth. The clinical trials that were done in the US, you know, which are reliable clinical trials, have shown not only that it doesn't work, that there's not even an indication that it works, like not even a little bit. It didn't even get off the ground in terms of being efficacious. So should we add bupropion? The answer is, it would be, of course, it would be a great idea if you could switch to bupropion. Person has SSRI-induced sexual dysfunction. If it is feasible, maybe if the person doesn't have an anxiety disorder, like a GAD, panic disorder, OCD or something, try to switch them to bupropion. Maybe we should have started with bupropion. I think bupropion is underutilized, really. due to reasons which you understand what the reasons are, but nevertheless, if I get major depression, you can be 100% sure I want to start on bupropion. Do you think I want sexual dysfunction? Do you think I want weight gain? Thank you. Now, if a person is, so there is, people will say, hey, but I had this patient, I added bupropion and it was much better. So there is a role for adding bupropion, which is that if the person is still depressed, let's say you have them on the SSRI, they not only have sexual dysfunction, but they're still continuing to be depressed. Well, then adding bupropion could be a good option. It could also be a possible, you know, cross titration, but also adding the bupropion, let's say the depression gets better. Now the person doesn't have the sexual dysfunction. The other thing is, what if the problem is mainly with desire? You know, bupropion, among all the different aspects of sexuality, might help with desire. So usually with antidepressants, as you know, SSRIs, it's an orgasmic problem is very prominent, but there can also be a problem with desire, and bupropion could help with that. So there is a small role. I don't want to say that there is no role for adding bupropion at all. Now, in the case of men who have erectile dysfunction due to the antidepressant, will a PDE5 inhibitor like Viagra and stuff like that, Cialis, will they work? Answer is yes. They work even in antidepressant induced erectile dysfunction. There's no difference like from erectile dysfunction that's idiopathic. And in men, you know, everything in those studies, they found like not only did erectile dysfunction improve, but like their desire was better, their ejaculation was better, their overall satisfaction was better. I guess in men, like everything is focused on the erection. Like you fix the erection, everything is fixed. They're good to go. But it's not as effective for women. Now, the PDE5 inhibitor that I recommend the most often is the tadalafil, brand name Cialis, but now the price has really gone down. It's only $1 for a 20 milligram pill. 20 milligram is a maximum dose, so they can take half of that. 10 milligrams should be sufficient for most patients. So that's 50 cents. Okay, the next one we're going to talk about is weight gain. Now, I must tell you in advance that I don't have a fantastic option for weight gain. If I had a fantastic option for weight gain, then I would not be sitting here doing this talk. I would be in my palace or something. So to treat medication-induced weight gain, the medication that I really want to encourage and promote, and I've been like trying to talk about this every chance I get, is to use metformin. Metformin 1000 to 2000 milligram per day. The other ones are, you know, not the best options. In general, if the metformin doesn't work, then I tend to go to medications that are approved for the treatment of obesity, which is not, we're not going to talk about those today, but you know about these things like, you know, Contrave and Saxenda, this liraglutide and so on. So we should know about metformin that there are many, many studies, placebo-controlled studies that have shown that metformin helps with weight gain due to second-generation antipsychotics. People think that topiramate is very effective. Not only does topiramate have unacceptable side effects in terms of, you know, cognitive impairment, 1% risk of renal stones, topiramate is associated with a 1% risk of causing renal stones. Do we tell patients that when we prescribe them topiramate? But also, metformin was actually little bit more effective than topiramate. So it's not that topiramate is the most effective option for weight loss. So now, it's not a miracle drug at all, you know, but it can cause a weight loss of about 5%, 7%, something like that. That's not bad. It helps with along with other things that the person might be doing to get 7.5% weight loss is not bad. That's an average. So, you know, some people will benefit more than that, some people less than that. Now, the thing is, we have to know whom should we prescribe metformin to. Firstly, we should be prescribing it a lot more than we currently are. That I'm very convinced of. I prescribe it regularly. One misunderstanding that people have is that metformin is a diabetes medicine, which it is. And so they think, oh, I would prescribe metformin if they had weight gain and they had diabetes. And that's not true. In fact, in all the studies that were done of metformin for medication-induced weight gain, people who had increased glucose were excluded. So all of those patients had normal serum glucose, and yet it works. Its mechanism is different. It has a complicated mechanism, but mainly it reduces insulin resistance. So that insulin is able to go into the cells and the fat can be unlocked and used. So we want to use it early on. That's the thing. If you wait, if you try it only in your patients who have gained 45 pounds, been on the antipsychotic for like 7 years and all that, and then you don't get a great result, you'll be like, this is not working. So use it younger, relatively early on. You know, one of the things we have realized in recent years is that people who gain a lot of weight, you know, there's a trajectory. They got weights going up in the first 4 to 6 weeks, and they're having like a tremendous appetite. 4 to 6 weeks, that's when we should think, like, right away. Don't start it on day one, of course, because you don't know that this person will need it. But 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, that's it. Somewhere in that window, you must think, okay, maybe I should start this person off metformin now. Because the early weight gain strongly predicts. You agree, right? I hope you agree. So if there's rapid weight gain early on. Now, how to prescribe it, you know, in general, it's a very, very safe medication unless the person is elderly. We do not give it above the age of 70 or so. We don't give it to people who have any heart failure, hypoxia, renal failure. Renal failure is not specifically mentioned on the slide, but that's a very important contraindication to taking metformin. So, you know, besides getting their weight and BMI and all that, we should check like a basic metabolic panel to look at creatinine. And we should make sure we know that their liver functions are okay. Otherwise, the person's not on oxygen and so on. So in an average outpatient who doesn't have these kind of serious medical illnesses, there's little problem. We should tell them a couple of things. When we are starting metformin, we should tell them a couple of things. We should say, hey, don't drink heavily. You need to use alcohol only in moderation. And secondly, take one multivitamin pill per day, because metformin can sometimes cause B12 deficiency. So it's good to take one multivitamin per day. The commonest side effect of metformin is diarrhea. A few patients can't take the metformin because of the diarrhea. So how do we do it? We prescribe the extended release preparation. We start with 500 milligram. We tell them, hey, whatever is your largest meal of the day, if you tend to have a heavy breakfast, don't have a heavy breakfast, then take it after lunch. Or take it after dinner. Start with that. Wait for like at least 1 week or maybe even 2 weeks, and gradually go up, you know, to 500 twice daily, and then ultimately to 1,000 twice daily. This is another thing. People will use metformin, but they'll use only 1,000 milligram per day. Higher dose is better. Please try to go to 1,000 twice daily unless the person is having unacceptable diarrhea. And then only one thing to monitor. We do not need to monitor finger stick blood sugar. Even though it's a diabetes medicine, it doesn't cause hypoglycemia. There is no need to measure blood sugar to see if the person is going to get hypoglycemia. That's not the case. But vitamin B12, once a year, you should check serum vitamin B12. Okay, and the last side effect that for today that we'll talk about is tardive dyskinesia. And I will talk about this briefly because I believe that we are having a separate talk on tardive dyskinesia, covering it in detail. So I'll say only a little bit about tardive dyskinesia. You know about that you should do the abnormal involuntary movement scale every 6 to 12 months formal. And then, you know, every time you see the patient, you should be keeping an eye out for involuntary movements. Frequently, it's missed. You want to catch it early on. So first thing you should do, again, tardive dyskinesia. Also, sometimes I've seen people trying to give an anticholinergic for tardive dyskinesia. That's the exact opposite of what you should do. Anticholinergics worsen tardive dyskinesia. You can think about it as a simple, let me tell you a simple way to think about it. Dopamine and cholinergic systems in the basal ganglia are in a balance. If you give a dopamine blocker like an antipsychotic, now there's imbalance. If you give the dopamine blocker for a while, then hypersensitivity occurs. And so there's a dopaminergic hypersensitivity. Now you give, and I hope you can see both my hands. If you give an anticholinergic, you're going to make the problem worse. You see, for tardive dyskinesia, it's different. Don't give an anticholinergic, should gradually taper it off. Now, if the antipsychotic is not essential, let's say the patient is getting the antipsychotic for major depression. This is a young woman who is getting an antipsychotic for augmenting the antidepressant. You see early signs of TD, should very seriously think, hey, maybe I should take this person off the antipsychotic if there are other options. You know, like with major depressive disorder, many times there are other options of things that you could do. At least we should think about it or like discuss with the patient. If for any reason the person is on a first generation, let's say you have the person on haloperidol, there has been a recent kind of like I can even call it a fashion to say that the first generation antipsychotics are fine, but in terms of tardive dyskinesia, of course they work, but in terms of tardive dyskinesia, do you think if I was to get an antipsychotic, would I want to get a first generation antipsychotic? No. Second generation antipsychotic. Now, quetiapine, if you're going to switch, keep in mind quetiapine and clozapine are better options from the viewpoint of tardive dyskinesia. Now, that may not be feasible due to other reasons, but at least we should know this. And of course, you know, there's been a lot of tremendous advance in the field in terms of specific medications which are effective for tardive dyskinesia have been introduced now, which you are probably very familiar with now, valbenazine and deutetrabenazine. So those are the VMAT2 inhibitors. Doesn't VMAT, like, it's like a rocket, like as a rocket is going to go off. It's the VMAT2 rocket. Vesicular monoamine transporter, you know, and what you know probably that what it does is, what VMAT2 does is, it takes dopamine and other monoamines from the cytoplasm and locks them away, protects them in the vesicles. And if you block the reuptake, then this dopamine can be metabolized and depleted. Anyway, stops them from being degraded. The two refers to the VMAT that's present in the CNS. That's what the two is. So at least just basically when we are using the term VMAT2, we want to know what does it mean. And the VMAT2 inhibitors, you know, we always had tetrabenazine, but it was expensive. It wasn't FDA approved for the treatment of tardive dyskinesia. Now we have these better versions, valbenazine, which is FDA approved, and we have deutetrabenazine, which is FDA approved. And we are able to get these medicines now with, you know, the companies that manufacture them also have very good programs where you call them and they help you with getting the prior authorization done for the medication. So this is exciting progress. Now, there are a few things that we can keep in mind. Like, again, I believing in the idea that there's not one silver bullet only. If the person had very severe, let's say a person with schizophrenia has to be on medication, tardive dyskinesia is severe and unacceptable, consider switching to clozapine. That's a possibility. A very weird recommendation. Now, I had a patient who had tardive dyskinesia and she was going to go to Florida to attend a wedding. And so I gave her actually risperidone. So remember, like in tardive dyskinesia, we have dopamine hypersensitivity. So if you give a potent dopamine blocker, temporarily the tardive dyskinesia will improve. So actually, either increasing the dose of the same medication, this is strange, isn't it strange? There's actually published study of risperidone to treat tardive dyskinesia, but remember, this is a temporary thing. Obviously in the long run, it'll make the tardive dyskinesia, probably make the tardive dyskinesia worse. But temporarily, we can use it to give relief if the person, like in my patient, had this social situation. Giving benzodiazepines also seems to reduce because TD gets worse when the person is anxious. Maybe that's the reason. But clonazepam seems to temporarily make the TD a little bit better. Amantadine is also being used. Ginkgo biloba have been used. These things I mentioned for the sake of completeness, but they are not really that effective, not really frequently done. And especially now that we have the VMAT2 inhibitors, there seems less need to struggle to use like things which are relatively unproven treatments. So coming back, I want to like urge you, as I have been trying now for many years, is encouraging clinicians. Side effects should be an important topic. I mean, I think we should thank NEI that has been doing a great job in giving emphasis to side effects. Most of the conferences you go to, there's like nothing on side effects. They'll have 15 talks on many different topics and nothing about side effects. It's like, we don't want to talk about side effects. Well, you know who cares a lot about side effects? Is the patient. The patient cares a lot about side effects. The patient frequently stops taking the medication because of side effects. So once again, we should have a menu of options. Do not try to make it one-to-one like for each side effect, but have many options in your mind. I've actually written a book about management of all kinds of side effects, in which I, for hundreds of pages, I go into literally, you know, more than 1,000 different tips about managing different kinds of side effects. And it just came out with a second edition. If you go to Amazon, you can see I have a book called Side Effects of Psychiatric Medications. Anyway, so you should learn somehow from wherever you get your information, should learn about these different side effects, and they can be non-pharmacological and pharmacological. They can be at different levels, and we have to use judgment as to, in each individual patient, how, you know, what kind of intervention is appropriate. Ultimately, there is no substitute for clinical judgment. And that's why you and I will never be out of a job.